Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2. Hello also to Birmingham, Unity FM on 93.5 in the Midlands, and not forgetting, of course, Radio Verulam in St Albans. This week we'll be talking to Nick Law, a local poet, who's written some verse and ballads and poetry entitled A True Account of the Villainous Bartholomew Rakehell, Ne'er-Do-Well, in an extremely well-presented book which is available now, parts of which are set in Bristol. We'll be hearing a bit of that and talking about Nick's inspiration and research. We will also be getting Julian Parry's View of the Week again, and today he's talking about the way the world is changing and how it's changing very fast, based on some of the things that have happened in the news this week that are very big in terms of the potential effects on the world. Big stuff. Following on from our feature from Michaela Dennis, who spoke to Katrina Percy from Bristol Event Volunteers, a local volunteering hub which connects people with events and opportunities they might be interested in, we have an interview done by her with Katrina Percy. We'll be hearing that too. Our roving reporter Anthea Page, who is on holiday still, has sent us another feature from her travels, so she has been industrious, this time from Radio Mozambique in Nampula, Mozambique, where she asks about the importance of radio broadcasting in the country. Tim Burrows reads us a poem, and sorry to say no What's On Guide this week, as Jeff is not here, but he will be back next week, hopefully, and in the meantime, we wish him and his family all the very best from Dialect. I'm John Peters Coleman. So, first up today, I would love to introduce our guest in the studio this week, Nick Law. Hello.
Good day.
So, you have a history as a writer, but for how long? How long have you been writing?
I've been writing this particular book, in fact, for the last 10 years.
Okay, wow. It's not a huge book. It's not like the thumping tome of best-selling popular novel style. So there's been a lot of editing and love and care it must have gone in, I assume.
It is a slim volume, it must be said. But the reason why it took so long is because of all the research that was involved in creating it. It's set in the 18th century, and I particularly wanted the book to have the look and the feel and the colour of that particular period. And that's down even to the fact that there are no modern words in the book whatsoever. But it's still purely readable.
Okay, so describe the book. You've got it in your hand.
I do.
So for the radio listeners at home who cannot see,
right.
describe what you're holding in front of you.
It is covered in burgundy cloth. Never mind the thickness, feel the quality.
Yes.
It also has gold foil blocked writing on it, which says the title, with a little codicil underneath which says, "Wherein are bawdy tales of boxing, bordellos and Bristol pluck."
Excellent. And the full title of the full grandiose title of the book?
Well, it's A True Account of the Villainous Bartholomew Rakehell, mm-hmm. Ne'er-Do-Well. So even the title is like an 18th century book title.
Yeah. Where was your initial fascination? Where did this come from?
I'd been working for some time with a company known as Past Pleasures, who are still in existence. And it was a very unusual job in that I had to tell people about various periods of history, working in places like Hampton Court Palace and the Tower of London, mm-hmm. whilst in costume.
Right, okay.
In the period of whatever I was talking about.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we also did were various literary festivals as well as historical festivals. And for 13 years, I think it was, we went to Tunbridge Wells and did an 18th century festival there. And it was during that period that I really picked up a love for this particular time and found out all about it and used that research in the book itself.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, you're halfway to having that. You've got a very cavalier sort of moustache that I'm very much admiring. I wish I could have a touch like that.
Thank you very much, yes. This is known as an imperial.
Really?
From the 17th century. That's okay. Where you have the moustache that curls up at both sides, mm-hmm. but also the little triangular piece under
the
bottom
patch.
Lip. Yes, that would be no moustache and just the triangular piece.
I see. Right, okay.
It's a complex business, facial hair.
It is. It's more complex than you would at first imagine. So give us a synopsis of the verse they're in. I understand there are three main stories that you read in the book.
There are. There's the first tale is called The Scientific Lesson, and that is about a young girl called Jenny Go-Sprightly, who is from Bristol, and she goes to London for the day and is ensnared by a old woman who runs a bawdy house or a bordello or a brothel. And she is intended to be the next victim of the eponymous villain, Bartholomew Rakehell. But what she doesn't know, and what he soon finds out, is that her father is one of the famous Bristol pugilists. Bristol had a great reputation for producing fantastic bare-knuckled boxers. And, of course, he's taught her everything he knows.
Yeah.
And she gives him a good drubbing.
I see. Right. OK. Well, and indeed, if you go to the hatchet, they've got a bit on the wall inside there about the pugilism that used to go on there. And the second story?
The second story is the land pirate, which is the 18th century word for a highwayman, one of them. There were many. And it's about what happens to Jenny Go Sprightly on her return to Bristol. And the coach that she's in, which contains various characters, there's a foppish gentleman, there is a quack doctor, there's a parson. All these characters are in the coach together, and they get stopped by Jack Fox. And it's what happens to them afterwards, and how she, again, being a feisty young girl from Bristol, how she gets her revenge on him.
Okay, and, well, perhaps we should keep the third story a little bit of a secret. We've got an idea of what the book is about, and also there is a sort of a bit at the end where there is also some poetry and a short story. Tell us a little bit about the short story, which is involves flowers.
Well, that came about again when I was working with Past Pleasures, and we were doing an event called a flower festival, which was for gentlemen of the 17th century who were mad, passionate gardeners and cultivators of rare flowers, for which they would often pay thousands of pounds, you know, for one seed. And they would have these meals, and each person would do a turn. So I wrote this short story in order for it to be my turn at this event, which was filmed, actually, and was shown on television. And it's 50 Old English flower names in the course of about, I don't know, a page and a half. And then there's an explanation of what the flowers are.
Incorporated into a story.
Incorporated into the story. And what we did was we turned it into, of course, as gentlemen did at that time, we turned it into a drinking game.
Okay, brilliant. Well, can you read us a little bit of your book?
Yes, I would be happy to. I'm glad that you said we'd keep the third story a bit of a secret, because that's what I'm going to read from.
Ah, okay, excellent.
This is from The Mermaid of Bristol, which is a ship. And I just have to paint the picture a little bit, because we're jumping into about the middle of the way through. The first thing I should say is that I know it's a Sunday afternoon, people are listening to this, so there are a couple of bawdy words, but nothing offensive.
Okay, good.
And I should also point out that the word tosspot in the 18th century meant a drunkard, someone who tossed the pot regularly.
Ah, okay, excellent.
So what we have here is some pirates are having a competition between themselves as to who can drink the most rum. And the person that they have chosen from The Mermaid of Bristol is Timothy Tosspot, who used to be a drunkard, but in all the time that he's spent, once he was press-ganged, on this ship, he's now become very sober indeed.
I see.
I hope that that will paint enough of a picture, and we shall start with here. "The challenge is this," Hornpipe said in a rage. "Goliath and David, round two we will stage. But no slingshots or stones are required to play, just livers and lights and a love of melee. Winner takes all in a trifling game. Who can drink the most rum and remember their name? And as an opponent for Bullock to beat, we choose yon boy who still sucks at the teat and can drink nothing stronger than old Adam's ale." He pointed at Tim, and Will Cutthroat went pale. "The soberest man near the crew? Nay, the fleet?" cried Cutthroat, by now almost white as a sheet. "Surely, by God, there is some other way," he implored, pasty-faced and the colour of whey. But Hornpipe just laughed, and then rubbed salt in the wound. "The mermaid is ours. You'll be left here marooned." This tirade was curtailed by an almighty roar. A bellowing bullock was calling for more. He threw back his head and decanted a bottle, and then, with a logic to Fox Aristotle, ran in a ring like a child with a hoop, flapping his arms like the sails on a sloop. But Timothy had one more trick up his sleeve, a surprise not yet seen in this recitative. He swallowed two flagons, then picked up a taper. Bullock stopped dead in the midst of his caper. The crowd held its breath. What would Timothy do? Something astounding was starting to brew. "I'm Timothy Tosspot. Remember my name," he said with a grin, and belched forth a flame. A dumbfounded silence was all that occurred. Then the cheers and huzzas were the loudest e'er heard. Hats were flung skywards and tables were thumped. The crew of the Dolphin seemed thoroughly trumped. "Watch this," said Bob Bullock, and copied Tim's trick. But his eyeballs were glazed and his speech sounded thick. As the liquor spilled out, he looked quite worse for wear, but he picked up a candle and stood on a chair. "My name is... My name is..." he slurred, looking grey, his beard dripping rum and his feet turned to clay. "I've forgotten the first part," he shamefully said, then gave a hiccough and set fire to his head.
That's a good, really good point at which to stop. I like that very much. So tell us more. Where can people get this book?
This is available from Tangent Books in Bristol, which is an amazing local publisher who take local writers and their dreams and turn them into reality.
Okay, so are they like an actual shop somewhere?
It's best if you go online. You can get the book from tangentbooks.co.uk.
Okay.
And it's available for the amazing price of just
£5.99. £5.99?
I know!
Fantastic. Well, that's a princely amount of stuff you're getting for £5.99. That's great. And where can people find anything more about yourself personally on the internet anywhere? Do you have your own sort of website or anything like that?
Yeah, there is a site, BartholomewRakehell.co.uk. I think there might be a hyphen in. We might have to stop
that. Well, that's all right. If people put that in Google or their favoured search engine or whatever, it will come up.
To be honest, if you put in Bartholomew Rakehell, it takes you straight to all sorts of things.
There's only one. Nick Law, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
The province of Nampula and Nampula City lies in the north of Mozambique and is divided from the rest of the country by several major rivers, one of which is the mighty Zambezi. I only mention this, of course, because our Anthea is there right now. She's reported and given us this picture. So, back to the mighty Zambezi. It's home to many matrilineal tribes. Islamic influences are also stronger here, with centuries-old ties to ancient Swahili trading networks. The north is also birthplace of Mozambique's independence struggle. The first shots of the civil war were fired in the village of Chai. The area around there is inhabited by one-third of Mozambique's population, but accounts for only one-fifth of the gross national product. It has the lowest literacy rates and seems to be a generally neglected area for the southern-orientated government. Dialect's reporter Anthea Page was in Nampula, Mozambique's third largest metropolis, a crowded city with a hard edge. In this feature, she visits the regional radio station of Radio Mozambique, the national broadcaster, to find out the importance of radio broadcasting to the north of the country.
I'm in one of the studios, and it's part of the main Mozambique radio network. I'm here with...
My name is Rafael Omar.
And can you tell us about your role here in the radio station?
Well, I'm in radio station since 1992. As a journalist, I have been a boss chief editor here. I have been, but I'm not so far because of some changes. But my role here, I'm editor. I edit news and current affairs here. I teach some children who are doing some programs here in the Radio Mozambique. I receive young journalists who are being trained by some universities we have in this city. We have a Catholic university that is training journalists in high level. And when they come here, I receive them, and in the stage that they make, my orientation and teaching, they become young journalists in this province and in this country.
Can you tell us a bit more about Radio Mozambique, how it operates?
The Radio Mozambique is the only radio, a government radio in Mozambique. It has its headquarters in Maputo, but it has about 11 branches in the province, namely Cabo Delgado, Niassa, Nampula, where we are now, Zambezia, Tete, Sofala, Manica, Inhambane, Gaza, and the Emissor Provincial de Maputo Provincial Broadcaster. So we have 11 branches, but the headquarters is just in Maputo. We have a president in Maputo, and we have delegates in provinces like this. mainly Radio Mozambique broadcasts in many, many languages. Portuguese, English, because we have a Maputo Corridor Radio in Maputo, and other regional and local languages. So here in Nampula, we broadcast in Portuguese as a national language, and we have Makua, a local language. So we broadcast from 4 a.m. until midnight. Yeah.
How easy is it for the people in the villages to listen to the national radio?
Well, frankly, it's not easy. The people living in the village to listen to the radio because our equipment is not so good. We have to be listening until approximately 100 kilometers. 200 is not possible. But we have radio station in all the province. If you stay, for instance, in Erati is a village 250 kilometers from here. It's very close to Cabo Delgado than to Nampula. So the people who are living in Erati, they listen Sol Provincial of Cabo Delgado because they broadcast both in Portuguese, in Swahili, in Shimakonde, and other regional languages. They can understand what the language spoken in that broadcaster. So it's not easy, the station of Nampula, to be listened so far away because of our equipment is not so good.
Do you cover news from other surrounding African countries?
Here in Nampula, we don't do that, but our headquarters in Maputo does that because we have correspondents in Durban, in South Africa, and we have correspondents in Malawi, just the two countries. But the journalist who was based in the boundaries close to other countries like Imanika, they sometimes go to Zimbabwe. For instance, in Tete, sometimes he goes to Zambia or Malawi. The journalist based in Pemba sometimes goes to Tanzania and brings some news. But especially in those countries where we have a Mozambican living in it, we have gone there and bring some news interesting to our citizens living in those countries.
The villages are very, very rural, aren't they? Very simple setups. Do you actually go out to the villages and interview people and get stories, or is it too difficult?
Yes, we do, but not frequently because of cost. For instance, we have a journalist who is touring in two districts of Interland here. It's Ribawe and Malema. He's doing a report about corn production. Every month, we have two journalists who go to the village to collect the information and bring here, to interview the people, to listen about their problems, their hopes, and something else.
How many different channels do you have? Like we have Radio 1, Radio 4, Radio 3.
We have about four channels in Radio Mozambique. One is a national channel we call Antena Nacional, National Antenne. We have Maputo Corridor Radio. It broadcasts to Southern Africa in Portuguese. We have Radio Cidade, is a city radio in Maputo. And we have these branches that I have told you in the provinces. So we have many, many channels in the Radio Mozambique, speaking both in Portuguese, in English, in local language. Here, for instance, in Nampula, we speak Portuguese and local language. In Cabo Delgado, for instance, they speak Portuguese and four other local languages spoken in Pemba, etc.
Do you have any commercial radio and community radio?
Not at all. We gather the things. We join the commercial radio and the informative radio. We have not a specific channel to commercials. I was forgetting, we have a specific channel for sports in Maputo. And we have branches in some provinces we call RM Sports. Yeah, 24 hours a day. Just speaking about sports and culture.
What's the most popular type of program that you produce?
The most popular program in Radio Mozambique is a program that we call Jornal da Manhã. It's a morning journal. You know, it begins at 6 o'clock and ends at 8 o'clock from Monday to Friday. On the weekend, the people like to listen all about sports. But this program, Journal de Demania, is very popular in all the country because it brings the news from all the provinces together and from 6 to 8 o'clock.
Is that prime time when people are going to work here? Because it gets light very early, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, because we have established the timetable for all the people who are going to work. We open broadcast at 4 o'clock because we have program that is related to the farmers. We tell the farmer that it's time to go to the farm. We teach them how to farm insecticides and the time of doing crops, what is good to produce in some time. So we accompany our farmers from 4 o'clock until 6 o'clock. So from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, we speak Portuguese because we broadcast a program that I have told you, the Jornal da Manhã, a morning journal, in which we bring the country together in a time.
People in the very remote areas of Mozambique, do they have access to a radio or not?
Yes, they do, because nowadays it's not so difficult to buy a radio set. It's not very expensive. Aside from that, we have community radios in some villages. It do not belong to us, but it belongs to the government itself. They broadcast in some language. And if Radio Mozambique has a very important program, they broadcast to the people living there. But each villager, or many of them, have a radio that they put in the knees, and they are going to the farmers with them listening in that time. It's not very difficult to get it.
How much influence do you think radio has on the life of those people, you know, in the rural areas?
I believe the radio, especially Radio Mozambique, is changing the life of the people of Mozambique, mainly the people living in the countryside, because they need to be informed. Instead of giving information, we educate the people and we entertain the people. And the villages especially need to be informed and need to be educated. For example, the Ministry of Health now is doing a campaign of immunization of the children. Is the radio he's making campaign, is informing the people that the Ministry of Health is doing a campaign of immunization of the people about malaria, about some diseases. Radio Mozambique does that job. In the time of election, for instance, the politicians give their information, they campaign through Radio Mozambique. That's why I'm telling that it plays an important role to the education of people, principally in the rural area where there is no television, they have no newspaper. The only way they get to be informed about what's happening in the country and abroad is just Radio Mozambique. If we receive news from abroad, we translate them into local languages and so that the people must understand.
Many thanks to Anthea Page on holiday and making herself useful at Radio Mozambique Regional Radio Station in Nampula in the north of Mozambique. With David Cameron relaunching his Big Society initiative, volunteering has become a bit of a hot topic. I'm Michaela Dennis, caught up with founder of Bristol Event Volunteers, Katrina Percy, an events-focused volunteer hub to discuss volunteering in general and hear more about BEV, the organisation.
Hello, with me today is Katrina Percy from Bristol Event Volunteers, co-founder of Bristol Event Volunteers. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for asking me to do this. I'm very excited.
Can you tell people what Bristol Event Volunteers, or just call me Bev, is about?
Yeah, Bev is a networking hub, essentially. So the idea is that it will become a searchable hub to bring events within the Bristol area together with people that want to find volunteering opportunities relevant to them. So it's marrying up these people together. And that's hopefully what's going to happen, because it's obviously still so new and shiny.
So how long has it been going?
It's been going since end of April, beginning of May last year. So it's still under a year old. But we have been getting a lot of positive feedback so far.
That's great. What kind of events are people kind of taking part in?
There are quite a mix, truth be told. So we'll be doing things. We've done the Bristol Media Five-A-Side event, which is held in the summer. We did that last year, and if anybody is listening, I'm hoping to do a little bit more with them next year, so hopefully that'll come around again. We have opportunities with another collective called Artspace Live Space, when they did a Christmas market for the local communities. We have an opportunity at the moment where a local director is doing a short film and is asking people to be in the background and be walking along and be in this big collective, and the meeting point is just his house and you come for a cup of tea. So it really is from one end of the spectrum to the other, but as long as it is an event, that's where we're focusing on, and that's where it'll be involved with Bev. So as great and as commendable as some volunteering opportunities are, for example, putting your time towards a homeless shelter for Christmas, handing out soup and things like that, is absolutely wonderful, and I can't speak highly enough of them, but that isn't the area that we're focusing on. It is more event and meeting people and building up relationships and things for your CV.
So how many people have you kind of got involved so far?
Well, we have several online spaces that people can get to know Bev and the opportunities that we have for them. So we have our website, which I haven't been pushing as much lately because the new shiny version is hopefully going to be launched any day now, where people will be able to actually sign up and have their own member profiles, etc. So we have probably about 50 people signed up for that, but that is going to be the main area that will grow. Then we have Facebook group, which is about 120-130 people, and we've got about 220 Twitter followers, and we have about 40 people on LinkedIn. So combined we probably have around 500-600 people.
And why do you think people want to volunteer at the type of events that you connect them up with?
Well, I struggled when I came out of uni finding work that I wanted to do, and it's only got worse now. It's only got harder to find opportunities. So I was throwing myself into everything that I could. I did radio, I did festivals, etc. And then I got involved with the Interesting Games Festival, which my co-founder Helen Bentley also is involved with even more so, and we were talking and said how hard it was to also find volunteers. So not only had I known how hard it was to find opportunities myself that I wanted to get involved with, but from the actual event side of things, they were struggling just as much. So the areas that, you know, both sides do benefit, but with volunteers the idea is that they will benefit from meeting new people. I actually have quite a few people when they sign up said, I'm new to the area and I need to get to know the place and meet people and see what's out there. And then, as I said, as a student, they need to make contacts, they need to have information to put onto their CV and things like that. So it can be quite wide, and I don't want to just focus on students, and I definitely want a lot of students to be involved because it's so beneficial, but I also want people that have maybe moved, haven't been in university for several years. There's no kind of limit.
It's a great, yeah, it's a great way to meet people but also get skills on the CV.
Exactly.
So obviously we are in the context of the big society at the moment. David Cameron has just recently relaunched his kind of slightly confusing proposals for the big society, and a big part of that is volunteering. I mean, what's your kind of opinion on why people want to volunteer and give their time freely?
I feel there are people that do just want to give back to the community, and that's beautiful. I love that. But I always find a lot of people want to volunteer because they feel that they're gaining something from it. It can be as small as that warm and fuzzy feeling, but a lot of the time people want to volunteer to physically gain something for themselves.
So there's a reality, you're saying, that people don't just do it because they're completely selfless saints of people. They do it because, you know, there's something in it for them, and there's no bad thing in that.
No, not at all. I think, you know, if you have the time to give up your own personal social time, and you can just do these events that benefit your whole community, then just fantastic. But there's nothing wrong in saying I volunteer because I got to meet somebody who helped me get a job. That's absolutely fine.
Do you find volunteering is quite rare? Because I personally don't actually know that many people who volunteer a lot of their free time. And I was just wondering, you know, in your circle of friends and your experience, and especially now with Bev, how do you think people kind of feel about volunteering generally in society? Would you say it's a rare occurrence?
I think it's becoming more popular, but I think it might feel a bit rare because people don't know where to look. And so that is the idea of Bev, is that I'm bringing all of these opportunities in one place and they don't have to Google and research and ask loads of people and make several phone calls and search for hours to try and find the perfect thing for them. It's in that one place. It takes out the time element of searching, and so hopefully more and more people will find about it, and then as it's easier and more accessible, it will increase, especially within the Bristol area anyway.
Well, you'd hope so.
Yeah. Well, there's so much stuff going on in Bristol as well. It might not be the same in every other city. Bristol is the second best place for the media industry to be in, I think. And there's about three festivals a month, especially when you hit summer. Three festivals a weekend when you hit summer. It's just absolutely packed. I don't know what it's like in other cities, but it'll definitely increase here, I feel.
So Bev is obviously very media related, as you said there. I mean, do you think that it's less worthy to give your time to, say, helping out at a cool festival where you're going to have loads of fun, compared to, you know, helping out at a library as a part of a local cooperative or something like that? I mean, what's your opinion on that? A slightly unfair question.
You could do both and balance it out, I suppose. It's more of your own personal feelings, I think. I don't think anybody should tell you to feel guilty for doing something that will benefit you.
Especially David Cameron.
Exactly, David Cameron. Because even a festival is going to bring joy to a community and to people that attend it. So I know it's not giving people a helping hand, but it is bringing people fun and therefore joy. And so if the volunteers weren't there to help, it wouldn't happen and you wouldn't get that community spirit. So I think it is, it's just how you look at it. Yeah, it's how direct it is, I suppose. But it still brings happiness at the end of the day.
And I was really interested in how Bev was set up, because this is completely an entrepreneurial act on your behalf. You're obviously giving your free time to set Bev up. And I was just wondering what inspired you to do that.
I wanted that something that was mine, something that I had achieved. And because I had had experience in festivals, both helping set them up, or events rather, and being that volunteer, I had a good view and knew that there was that need for something like Bev. So it was a little bit of a combination of different things, really.
How would you encourage other people who've got a similar idea to actually do it? Because obviously you have a full-time job as well. What would you say to those people who've got an idea and are not quite sure whether to make something of it?
Definitely take time to think about it. I think the one thing that if I had time again to do it again, I would have had the idea and then taken a step back and thought about it. I literally had the idea, and then about an hour later I had a Twitter page, a blog, a Facebook page, and then I went, right, and I had to throw myself into it and think really quickly. So I would definitely give time to develop it. I think you have to have a little bit of patience there and know that it will happen in the end. It's always good to run your idea past other people and get feedback from them. And if you have somebody that's also passionate about the same thing that you can go in with, that might be a little bit more of a personal issue, because I work really well with others. I much prefer having that environment than a solo adventure or whatever it might be. So those would be my three things.
So if people want to find out more about Bev, do you have a website that they could go to? How can they get in contact with you?
I do. So it's bristoleventvolunteers.co.uk, soon to look even nicer than it does. And you can find us on Facebook, just search for us, and Twitter, which is BristolEV, at BristolEV.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Katrina, for talking to me.
No worries at all.
Thank you to Michaela Dennis for talking to Katrina Percy, founder of Bristol Event Volunteers. To find out more and become a volunteer yourself, that's you right now, you can find out more information at bristoleventvolunteers.co.uk and via the ubiquitous Facebook and Twitter. Just search Bristol Event Volunteers. Time for a song, and this is Kasabian with LSF, or Lost Souls Forever.
I'm on it, get on it, the chips are on fire, you know I need it, much closer, I'm treading just a little, I must step on it, electronic, the chips are on fire, I'm much deeper, a sleeper, I'm waiting for the final trip. Come on it, get on it, I'm carving through a let up, all I need it, life potions, drugs are just an hour away. Come on it, electronic, a polyphonic roster to the mortars, on fire, messiah for the animals. I'm treading just a little, I must step on it, electronic, the chips are on fire, I'm much deeper, a sleeper, messiah by the animals.
That was Kasabian with Lost Souls Forever from the album entitled Kasabian. And now, well, I was about to say, and now for a big orchestral stab, ready to introduce Julian Parry, stabbing the general vernacular that you use if you're in radio. But last week there wasn't one, but this week I'm sure that there is. So let's have it now. This is Julian Parry with The World This Week.
Well, hello. The world is changing, and it's changing fast. For the last 100 years, the world's economy has been increasingly dominated by the Federal Reserve Bank of America, a private organization set up under an act of Congress signed by President Woodrow Wilson in 1913. Woodrow Wilson, a president bought and paid for by banking interests. A short time after, President Wilson was quoted as saying, "I am a most unhappy man. I have ruined my country. Its system of production is now subject to its system of credit, now in the hands of private bankers." He meant the Federal Reserve. That institution and others like it in Europe are responsible for unleashing inflation on the world through printing money. What has followed, economically and geopolitically, is a direct result of the concept and practice of central banking, fiat money, and fractional reserves. Even so, the Fed is now being utterly reckless in its attempt to export America's national debt by de facto devaluing the dollar. I've just watched an incredible video that shows Americans are finally waking up to the financial fraud they've been living under for the last 100 years. If you want to see it, go in the URL line on your internet screen to dailybail.com, dailybail, lowercase, all one word, dailybail.com, and you'll find it there under There Are No Words to Describe the Following, Part 2. The confused and defensive testimony, you see, of the Inspector General of the Federal Reserve makes it clear that she either does not know or is not prepared to say just how much money has been printed. That is why there can be no greater nonsense than current proposals in the UK to raise domestic interest rates to stave off inflation. All the money that goes then to the very same banking system that has created the inflation in the first place, and now tries to export that inflation through de facto devaluation. No wonder China, Japan, Russia and France held meetings that excluded the US and GB when talking about the need for a new reserve currency. Nonetheless, when Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke appears before Congress soon, he is expected to signal that the central bank is unlikely to cut short its $600 billion stimulus plan. In other words, business as usual for the Federal Reserve. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, the center of the world as far as energy supplies are concerned, there is chaos, and the US is finally losing its grip. When George Bush came to power, he unleashed a neoconservative policy across the region aimed at entrenching American control. It led to the invasion of Iraq and all that followed, including the virtual imprisonment of the Palestinian people in the awful circumstance of Gaza that many would say is an affront to humanity. These last couple of weeks, we have seen that policy blow up in America's face as the new connectivity that Hillary Clinton acknowledged only yesterday takes hold. She was, of course, speaking of the ability of a computer-savvy younger generation to view and share views and organize concerted action on the large scale via bulletin boards, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. The trouble started in Tunisia when a single street vendor, young man, set himself alight in protest at police brutality and harassment. The trouble has quickly shot through the whole of North Africa to Egypt, Jordan, and Bahrain. It is now in the last 2 days in Yemen, Oman, Iraq, Kuwait, and is going into Saudi. Collectively, these countries represent 30% of global oil output. More importantly, they are close to the major oil transit choke points, the Suez Canal and the Straits of Hormuz, through which much oil moves to international markets. Key workers are fleeing Libya, and there is sabotage in Iraq. Egypt is at a standstill. Oil prices and the geopolitical risk to key producers is on the rise. And no single producer can supply or replace the supply that is being lost, even if Saudi says it can. WikiLeaks has let the world know that some American officials think Saudi reserves are overstated by as much as 40%. Meanwhile, the people of Europe are growing restive. Already trouble has returned to Athens, where last week petrol bombs were thrown and a policeman was quite literally ignited by the action. In Ireland, Fianna Fáil has been rejected wholesale at the polls because the Irish people have woken up to the fact that the €72 billion bailout, part of funded by Britain, will be costing them 85% of their income tax payments in service costs by 2012. Ireland is almost in open political revolt against the EU. Perhaps that is why the UK Parliament itself is beginning to revolt against Brussels, starting with a rejection of the ruling on votes for prisoners. It seems ironic that the same Europhiles who, in the name of democracy, seek to impose rule by 27 unelected bureaucrats upon 500 million people should now find their own control breaking down within their own membership. Is this the beginning of the end for the EU? Here in Britain, the coalition government is trying to get the economy under control by reversing the ludicrous spending of Blair Brown years. If it is to succeed, it must repeal those ludicrous regulations that hold industry back. Soon they will be no longer have bureaucrats needed to enforce them anyway. no means of granting the permissions required, and more delay that will bring even faster economic decline. Perhaps they should follow the people and simply adopt the popular internet-based proposal of passing the Great Repeal Act all in one go. Whatever action is taken, governments had better move quickly, for a veritable tsunami of coordinated citizen action is now spreading out worldwide, courtesy of the internet. Even the shores of the US are in sight, as one in four county communities registers significant decline in both population and economic output. The generation of the dispossessed are seeking retribution. The New World Order that Blair foretold in 1997, and which Gordon Brown so recently announced was emerging, is turning out to be nothing like the New World Order that the Illuminati have worked for all these years. The tide of history is turning against them all. After 100 years of selfish and self-serving manipulation of the many, the money masters are slowly destroying themselves, once more proving plop, Parry's law of perversity. He who proposes that which is unethical shall receive the exact opposite of his heart's desire.
Thank you very much. How long did it take you to prepare all of that?
Well, there was quite a lot of research done by our friends at Al Jazeera, and, of course, the internet site that produced that wonderful video. So I must confess that I've had some assistance, but it did take me most of the day.
Okay, and the website you came across, you said you watched a video that shows Americans are finally waking up to the incredible financial fraud that they have been living under. Daily Bail, as in B-A-I-L, dailybail.com. There are no words to describe the following. How did you come across that?
It was sent to me in an email by a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, who is in Germany at the moment. He's filming. And I also received today another one about oil production and peak oil flows, where there was a lot of information in there as well. So I had two gifts from my friends, which managed to combine with other stuff from Al Jazeera to make today's presentation.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I very much look forward to what you have to say in the future as well. Julian Parry, thank you.
Thank you.
About 300 years ago, our fields were privatised or enclosed, and with that, most of our common rights were extinguished. But where commons remain, so do the vestiges of our common rights. So that's our topic for this feature from Tony Gosling. One of the areas close to Bristol where there are still a lot of commons where we can study this is in the Cotswolds, and in particular Stroud. Farmer Paul Griffiths explains more.
Edge Common is another little-known spot. It's tucked neatly away inside the V between the roads from White's Hill and Stroud, which join together at Edge Village to head towards Gloucester. There's rare butterflies and orchids to be found here, but one thing you wouldn't expect to spot would be a tank. Yet, during the Second World War, tanks were seen somewhat surreally here. Manufactured in Gloucester, they were brought up to Edge Common to be test-driven. Edge Common is especially fortunate in having had, as a faithful steward, someone who, virtually single-handed, has cared for it most of his life, the local farmer, Paul Griffiths.
Hello, I'm Paul Griffiths. I'm still on Edge Common, otherwise known as Rudge Hill. I live over the ridge in Stockend Woods. And these are my cattle, which graze the common from August through till March. It is part of a grazing programme instigated by Natural England for the Duke of Burgundy butterfly, which is very rare and feeds and breeds up here. This is common land owned by the Blow family, who are the Lords of Manor at the Painswick Manor. And it extends from here right through to Painswick Beacon in the far distance, on round to other commons, right round to Juniper, which is opposite here on the far side of the Painswick Valley. Natural England manage it on behalf of the Blow family. I am a commoner, which entitles me to commoner's rights. My parents registered these rights back in the 60s when the Commons Registration Act came in. I have rights for grazing over the common. There are other commoners' rights, or cottagers' rights, as I've always known them, and they include turbary, which is the right to take peat, turf, or leaf mould for your gardens or for your forests, estovers, which is to take the underwood or branches or wood for repairing your fences, for your firewood, or other uses. There's piscary, which wouldn't apply up here, which is rights to take fish from other streams and ponds, although I shouldn't think too many would be happy about that. Panage, which covers pigs, really, and that would be in the beech woods and the oak woods, and in the autumn to look for the beech mast and the oak apples. And finally, common rights to the soil, which means you could take gravel and stone, but I don't think the powers that be would be too happy with that. Another important reason for this commons, the grazing project on this common, is to help the wildflowers. We've got about 14 varieties of orchid up here and many other wildflowers throughout the year. Cowslips are very important for the Duke of Burgundy's butterfly. My cat are a mixed bunch from the old faithful Gretel, black and white one here, and her descendants. She's 19 year old, and there are Gloucester cattle, which are the traditional Gloucester breed with their black heads, mahogany bodies and white tails. They've been gradually bred up to be really a really healthy population now to what they were 30, 40 years ago, and they graze this common and keep the grass short to encourage all the wildflowers to come through. Another reason for the grazing and management of the common is the skylarks. We've got a good population of skylarks up here, and they like the rough, high, taller grassland up on the top here, whereas the butterflies are on the lower slopes.
Thank you very much to a farmer from Stroud called Paul Griffiths. They're talking about our common rights, many of which were extinguished during the 300 years or so ago land enclosures or privatisations. It's time for our poet of the week. Well, in fact, we have two to choose from this week because they both turned up, but we're going to have Tim Burrows this week. Hello.
Hi. The first one's a serious poem, the second is a bit lighter and more zen. The first one's about Bristol. I want to unlock the secrets of this city, turn the key to the dark vault of the past, to the hidden tunnels beneath the downs, down which the slaves were led shackled. As tea was sipped in the merchant's hall, in the hot baths beside the Severn, as she curled out to East Africa, Dahomey and Guinea, in the Triangle of Death, to the sugar plantations of Jamaica, to the tobacco plantation of Virginia. Tea was so easy to drink, sweetened with sugar, crushed in limb-crunching presses beneath an unforgiving sun. Prayers were easy to say for good Christian merchants who had saved their stolen captives from their idolous gods, even if some were lost at sea, chained in a sewer beneath deck, even if some were lost to beatings and others ran for freedom, a profit could still be made after the weak and sick were fed to the sharks. The fine churches and buildings of this and other European cities bear fine testament to the Triangle of Shame and the millions of Africans who were sacrificed on it to the pagan god of gold. Forgive our ancestors, as they pretended to know not what they did. In God's name, let us help Africa to rebuild herself and her dispersed descendants to live with pride in their former captives' land and to glory in their independence.
Thank you. And now, just to sort of, whilst people take on board that, you have a sort of a brief Zen poem to complete your...
This is a lighter one. Sometimes I like to feel light, like I am no one in a place that no one knows, where the cares of the world cannot rest their load, where my mind can rest easy in the stillness of meditation, still as a mountain.
Thank you very much. And into the chill night you go until another week.
Yes, thanks, John.
Thank you. That's all from Dialect this week. Our hour is up already. Our studio guests were the wonderful Nick Law and also Julian Parry. Our features were by Anthea Page, Tony Gosling and Michaela Dennis, and Tim Burrows treated us to a poem. Two, in fact. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce and the producer was Michaela Dennis. If you would like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectradio.co.uk and, of course, on the Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. That's goodbye from myself, John Peters Common. See you next week. Goodbye. I'm